Hello and welcome to the Games Press, a monthly podcast series in which I interview people from around the games media about their work. And in today's episode, I'm talking to Ethan Gash from Kotaku, who has done a lot of reporting on the lawsuit filed against Activision Blizzard back in July, which detailed a laundry list of issues at the company when it comes to gender discrimination, sexual harassment, and a frat boy company culture. Ethan has been writing about the many new developments in this story as they've happened, which most recently includes a growing pressure on Activision Blizzard CEO Bobby Kotick to resign from his position. At the time of recording this podcast, he hasn't done that. But yeah, Ethan was also the first reporter to reveal what the Cosby suite at BlizzCon actually looked like, which is something that was mentioned in the lawsuit, but only really by name, and we'll be talking about that later on as well. Now, before we get into the interview, I'd like to thank Loading for continuing to help us make the Games Press happen. They run a total of 3 gaming bars across the south of England, including venues at Hackney, Peckham, and home of People Make Games, Brighton. You can turn up with your pals, grab a board game from their extensive collections, or maybe set yourself up by a console, all free of charge, as long as you buy some drinks or some food. They're really great places to hang out, and we thank them for supporting this show. And now, Ethan Gash. Hello, Ethan. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I've been very eager to have you on here because of all the reporting you've been doing around Activision Blizzard. Although I felt like I've needed to wait a little bit, both to see how the story develops, but also to make it seem like there's a little bit of space between this episode and the episode in which Patricia was on, so that I don't seem like I've got any kind of Kotaku bias.
Right. Well, and also Tina and me. Currently EIC at IGN, so...
Oh, no, I do have a Kotaku bias. Okay, well, that's good to know. But yeah, this section of your reporting on it, I guess, began with the lawsuit that broke in late July. Would you be able to give us kind of a brief overview of what that lawsuit was about, what some of the key allegations were, just so everyone's sort of on the same page?
That should be easy enough, since I've written that paragraph in dozens of stories now.
Yeah, I bet.
The California lawsuit that I think was news of at least broke on July 20th, and it's the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing.
That's right.
Had a very long complaint filed against Activision Blizzard alleging widespread sexual harassment and discrimination, specifically a frat boy culture. The allegations included cubicle crawls where predominantly male employees would drunkenly go by female colleagues' desks and, you know, there were accusations of women being asked to pick up the slack for men while they were, you know, playing Call of Duty, for instance, of not being given the same opportunities, of racial bias as well in workloads and promotions, as well as specific allegations of sexual harassment against particular people. I mean, one of the most notable things about the lawsuit, I think, was that there were only 3 people mentioned and only 2 by name. It's been so long now, but I think, I don't know, does that suffice as a summary? I have so many thoughts on the lawsuit itself and how it's been taken over the last 3-4 months.
Yeah, I think there were so many things mentioned in it, but I guess a couple of other things that spring to mind was also at the time of the lawsuit being filed, there was like 20% of Activision Blizzard's workforce were women, with few of them in very senior roles. And also the fact that when some people came forwards with these complaints prior to the lawsuit, they felt that they were then suffering professionally for making those complaints in the first place.
Yes.
How did you find yourself taking the lead on that story as it developed at Kotaku? Was that something you were assigned by an editor, or did you request it? Or
I'm trying to even remember now. I know Luke Plunkett, our evening editor based in Australia, wrote up the lawsuit. It was a very odd day because I remember I think it was just that day I had finally published a big report on Ubisoft Singapore.
Right.
And specifically about the work culture there. And I was going through, whenever that happens, you tend to get, you know, a little barrage of sources who will be like, either usually from the studio in question being like, oh, that's so true. Or, you know, this thing also happened to me. Or, you know, occasionally you'll get people who say like, that's not the studio I know, and I've never encountered any of that.
Sure.
But I remember there was one email specifically about the allegations at Activision Blizzard, and I was just parsing it very quickly, and I thought like, oh, is this someone, a former female employee who's now suing for discrimination. So I sent the link over to Luke, and then like looking through it, you know, more substantially, I was like, oh wait, this is from the state of California. Like, this is huge. And I think it was Bloomberg Law that first broke it. And it's one of those things that, you know, when Wario64, one of these big gaming accounts, like tweets news out, like it ripples across immediately. But it took that, I think, the gravity of what was being alleged a long time in terms of the span of that day. And so I just immediately, you know, the question is follow-ups. And I, even at that time, Kotaku was going through one of its many recent weird staffing changes, where I think we had not yet hired a slew of new writers as we have now over the past 3 or 4 months. And so I had already been doing a lot of the Ubisoft reporting and speaking specifically to victims of sexual harassment and misconduct. And so I don't even know if I requested it or just jumped in, but it was one of those things where it was kind of like not skipping a beat, just to like directly pivot.
So the lawsuits being filed was covered during that evening shift. But what are the kind of first steps that you take when you know you want to be following a story like that and ideally doing some of your own reporting on top? Like, what are those first steps like?
It's hard because there's so much and there's more than any one writer could bite off. And obviously, mm-hmm. if you're at like the New York Times or somewhere, there'd be a team of people and you'd each be picking up different parts. And Kotaku, even among gaming sites, is just very small. And I think it's partly to its benefit that we tend to hit so much above our weight. But the weird thing about a lawsuit like that is like they've done the reporting for you. Like, it's usually you either get a scoop or, you know, with Ubisoft the year prior, allegations started to break on Twitter. And so then you're trying to track them down and corroborate. But so here it was like going through the lawsuit and trying to pick apart, like, which are things that are specific enough that we could start to ask people about. And it was, you know, so with our resources, I think we wanted to pick at specific details. You start to go through Twitter and you see who is tweeting about this, who has worked previously at the company, who is still at the company. Are they willing to talk on background or off the record? And then, you know, there's always the question of like, are you going to try and do the systemic culture piece? What, you know, what are, you know, drill down into the anecdotes about what it was like for people in the day-to-day at these studios and how that does or doesn't go along with what is reported in the lawsuit. Specific instances of the most sort of, you know, like just striking examples of alleged abuse. And so, I mean, usually it's making a list on like a Google Doc, at least for me sometimes, of just all of the sort of major allegations and then all of the people talking about them, potential sources we already have, who we can start talking to, who can start corroborating stuff, and kind of just going down the list. And it's almost very workmanlike. It feels like cramming for a test in a way, where it's just like you go from one page to the next and you slowly build more and more information. Until you're ready to report something new or to corroborate something. Because that's also, you know, one of the hardest things about this type of reporting is a lot of people will make public testimonies on Twitter. Something we've been doing more and more, Kotaku is trying to, you know, you don't want to just automatically publicize something someone put out there without their permission, because you don't know how it's going to land. You don't know if they even thought of that possibility of how it could target harassment at them. And so then you have to go through all of these with a fine tooth comb and see who wants to actually put it, you know, on the record, so to speak, versus just tweeting about it. And so it's just a lot. It's just a lot of legwork to go through all that.
I've actually been thinking a lot recently about a tweet that I did at that time, which you ended up doing a follow up piece on, to do with a woman who had spoken at a BlizzCon panel a number of years ago. And was basically asking about the character designs in World of Warcraft and whether or not there was room for some of them to not look like they were Victoria's Secret models. And she got mocked by the developers on the panel. She was booed by men in the room. It was this awful thing. And I found it very upsetting to see. And this kind of has been like a special show to me and something that I've always really enjoyed going. And then seeing a woman have such a different experience was something I felt like it might give some context for people to see. That tweet ended up going viral, and suddenly I was hit with the realization that I don't actually know how that woman feels about being in a viral tweet all these years later,
right?
In which she's criticizing Blizzard publicly, and suddenly there's all these new eyes on it. And yeah, it was something that you ended up doing a follow-up piece on and spoke to the woman. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Just what that piece looked like,
right? So you You had tweeted it out, and I think some other people might have either independently tweeted it out or just started tweeting their own version after seeing yours or whatever, but it became like a number of tweets about it were going viral.
Yeah, I wasn't the first one to find it. I think I just had clipped the video in a way that made it easier to watch on Twitter, and that became the one that seemed to get the most traction.
Yeah, and I think for certain long-time BlizzCon people and Blizz fans, it was like a moment that they remembered, like it lived on in the subculture. But I mean, so it was very obvious, just like, you know, what does this person want to talk about this? Do they have a story to tell? I mean, because it was just such a perfect encapsulation of not just, you know, of again, the alleged underlying culture at Blizzard, but I think in retrospect, we would see at a lot of gaming companies, especially prior to like the last 5 years, where there are just openly in front of thousands of people mocking not only this female fan, but her concerns about the sexualization of these characters. I think I can't even remember, but it was just a matter of like, okay, so this, you know, how do we track this person down? Mm-hmm. And then eventually someone claiming to be that person responded to the comments, mentions in either your tweet or someone else's tweet.
Yeah, that's right.
And so just, you know, did the thing that I hate to do as a reporter, which is to tweet out your request for an interview as like, hi, I'm a reporter. Will you speak to me? Shot in the dark. But they did respond and emailed me, and then, you know, we're able to check out all their information, and, you know, here's this person 10-ish years later, I forget.
Yeah, I think it was maybe BlizzCon 2012, so yeah, almost a decade, I guess.
Yeah, and she has a family now, and, you know, she has a whole other life. And yeah, it was just fascinating to hear the backstory. I mean, you never know how some people wouldn't be interested in speaking about this 10 years later. She's still a big Blizzard fan. She still played World of Warcraft, and so it's very much still a live issue for her. And, you know, it's just a great interview. It's great as a writer. It's one of those things where it's like, oh, like, you know, I didn't do anything here. This person is a great interview, had a story to tell, and it's something that people were really interested to hear about.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, super thoughtful answers to your questions. And also, she clearly recognized the moment that was happening and wanted to add her voice to that. It's just you saying that before of how, you know, even like a Blizzard employee might tweet something and not quite realize how far that reach should go. I'm reminded that I would thought I was tweeting that to my followers in a sort, and I was just kind of mad and
right.
Upset. And when it went viral, yeah, just realizing that I'd done that on someone else's behalf did not feel great. And I'm glad it worked out in the end. But
how many Twitter followers do you have?
20,000.
I have 3,000. So I can do the two step of like, I'm going to tweet like a news person now, and now I'm just going to shitpost. But like, yeah, it's. I'm sure it's hard when you get to a certain point to know like, when am I just sharing news versus making news by sharing it?
Exactly. Yeah, and I think I had sort of forgotten which hat I was wearing then, and it was just it was definitely a learning moment for me of like controlling those emotions regarding stories like that when other people are involved, and making sure that you're not like launching someone else into the spotlight without their permission. Anyway, my mistakes aside, so when you first begin that process of kind of reaching out to sources that you might already have or Kotaku might already have and trying to establish new ones, given the nature of this topic, both in relation to it being like, you know, largely about sexual harassment and misconduct, and also that there's a lawsuit has been filed and that's in motion, and finally that if someone talks to you under anonymity and you as a journalist don't respect that properly, it can be a risk to certain employees. How do you build that trust in those first moments in terms of reaching out to potential sources to start talking to?
So my tact, and I don't know if it's, there's not necessarily a science behind it. It fits with my personal, you know, my personality, is to basically start out by apologizing and say, I'm very sorry for reaching out. You know, depending on whether or not it's someone who might just have information about a thing or someone who might, or has already spoken about having been subject to certain misconduct or mistreatment. You know, it's basically trying to acknowledge what a weird and intrusive thing it is to have a stranger reach out to you about your personal story.
Yeah.
And to kind of give them an out immediately to say, like, if you don't want to talk, that's completely fine. I don't want you to feel compelled, you know, in the way that you will with a stranger, where like if someone contacts you, your natural instinct is to say something back and basically give them that out and say, if you don't want to talk, it's fine. If you do, here's my information. Here's the type of story we're looking into. And, you know, basically, unless someone comes to us wanting to share their specific story, our main trend tends to be to focus on systemic issues. And so if letting people know that we're not looking to get into the nitty-gritty of publicizing their personal experience, but of corroborating and showing how, you know, something that one person experienced, these dozen other people did too. Because the one thing you find, and I think part of what you see people pour out during social media like this is they, first of all, a lawsuit like this, they read it and they say, oh my gosh, I experienced this thing and I wasn't even part of this lawsuit. I didn't even know that it was going on. And it all of a sudden makes them feel not only validated and recognized, but if, you know, they feel more empowered, I think, to share their experience, feeling like they're not just some exception or that people won't believe them or that they'll be ostracized in some way. So that's a roundabout of way of saying, you know, dozens and dozens of emails and messages. And then obviously if someone is willing to get on the phone with you, that's a huge way you build trust. I'm envious of journalistic professions where people predominantly, or at least a much larger amount of the time, get to speak to people face to face or over the phone, because immediately when you hear someone's voice and you talk to them, you can get a feel for them and you'll immediately it's much easier to build trust that way than just getting a cold email that might as well be like a solicitation from some random LinkedIn spam post. And you're just like, usually the second someone is willing to get on the phone with you or even just exchange a couple emails, if you're doing it well and the job you should be doing, they'll start to feel that you're not just there to try and exploit their story. And a lot of that comes from giving certain types of sources a lot of leeway in what they actually want to share. A lot of people think speaking to a reporter is going to be like being cross-examined by a lawyer. And, you know, there's certainly, like, if I was speaking to Bobby Kotick, that's how I would proceed in some ways. But I think it's letting people know that you're not just going, that the second that they open up to you, you're not just going to run to the masses with whatever they told you and just throw it all over the place irresponsibly.
And were you surprised by how many people did end up wanting to talk? I mean, whether that was through social media or new reporting, it felt like the floodgates were opened almost, and that there was so many people willing to share their stories in some form.
I always get more no's than yeses, dramatically more. 5 to 10% batting average is usually like great in that kind of thing. I think one thing, I mean, sites like IGN, Polygon, Kat Bailey at IGN did, I think, the first follow-up report within the first week or so after the story broke, where it was like, you know, had new information about what discrimination certain people at the company had faced, and kind of got into telling a story about people specific. You know, one thing that the lawsuit can't do is wrap a narrative around what people have experienced and kind of give you a larger context for this company that is Activision Blizzard, or in that case, Blizzard specifically, you know. And so there were so many journalists like her, Nicole Carpenter at Polygon, Megan over at Axios, Shannon Lau over at Washington Post Launcher, who were just like, everyone was doing this work at the same time and telling different parts of the story that never, I mean, the worst thing that I feel like can happen in the situation is where a bunch of outlets are racing for this exact same scoop and you just end up recreating each other's work. But I don't know, this is the one of those instances where I think everyone's work helped each other and made it stronger and helped encourage more people to want to speak, because they saw that like the story kept progressing. And so it wasn't a matter of this came out, some people talked, and now the hammer's going to come down on them. They're going to be blacklisted. You know, Kotick's going to send their lawyers after them. So definitely, I think everyone adding more and more in the weeks that progressed created a way, and it helped in a way where other stories might have just died and people would have claimed up. And obviously the workers at Activision Blizzard were a big part of that, because they immediately started planning a walkout and creating a sort of alternate channels for employees to tell their stories.
Did you feel like you were contacting people that also have been contacted by other journalists? Like you mentioned that you weren't necessarily racing for that scoop, but could you feel that there were other journalists in the same area?
Oh, yeah, that definitely happened a few times. And some people will contact you and they'll tell you like, hey, I'm also speaking to this other person.
Right.
And then usually it's never there's never an ideal way to frame it because it's just the nature of the job. But then you're always like, okay, that's perfectly fine. You please share your story with whoever you want. But if you can give me any sense of like, if I'm talking to you now, is this a story we should proceed with soon versus later? But yeah, no, that happened a few times. And then it's usually, part of it is it's the nature of just like so many people's experiences were the same, similar types of even just routine sort of discrimination or browbeating that you would get that just kind of people, not only was I getting people telling me the same things that is being reported in the Washington Post or in IGN, but you're getting the same things that different employees are telling you. So yeah, but it was definitely, there were several instances in which people were talking to multiple people.
Was it about a week later that you wrote the Bill Cosby suite story?
I guess it was. I don't even remember. It felt like it was like a month later, but I think it was only like 10 or so days or something.
Right. Okay.
I guess it was still in July. So yeah, it had to have been within a week-ish.
Could you give a brief overview of what that story was? I guess I'll start you off. There was a reference to there being a Bill Cosby suite in the lawsuit itself, but the details were kind of very limited. What was the story that you wrote?
One of the most kind of head-turning moments in the lawsuit is where they mentioned this Cosby suite and just wondering like, what is actually going on there? Like, what is that a reference to? Like, what is it?
It's a weird name to have like dropped in the middle of a lawsuit like that.
Right. And the lawsuit even misspelled it as Crosby Suite. And it just became...
Oh, I didn't remember that. Right.
They later sent an amended version to the court fixing it. Okay. But so the story was basically that the Cosby Suite was this alleged suite that certain Blizzard developers would have at events like BlizzCon or GDC. And it was, basically there would be a suite that was the one where they would all, people of a certain clique would all meet, bring their other friends or other fans. There would be lots of drinking. And there were pictures posted from one of these instances on Facebook. I believe it was the 2013 BlizzCon that showed a number of then current Blizzard developers posing with a giant portrait of Bill Cosby in a room where, according to sources, there was tons of booze. And according to one picture, there was tons of booze. And, anyone who's been to a conference event like that, kind of regardless of your knowledge of Blizzard, kind of knows what the mood is of a room like that. Now, this particular one, not only being the Cosby suite, but being, again, according to sources, the suite of Alex Afrasiabi. I'm probably mispronouncing his last name, but someone who was one of only two people named outright in the California lawsuit as sexually harassing female coworkers at Blizzard and also fans at events. And he's in the center, it's his suite. He's in the center of this picture. And again, I think similar to the BlizzCon panel clip of the male developers all laughing about this question, it was a sort of weird encapsulation of this alleged culture of people abusing their position of, in cases, at least in Alex's case, allegedly using it to prey on other people. I should remind people that there's disagreement over the name of the Cosby suite. Sources that spoke to me and also some that spoke to Bloomberg said that it was a joke about how ugly a room looked one year at, I believe it was a GDC. People who had been to the suite and heard about the stories of the suites didn't necessarily know what it was a reference to. All they knew was that they had heard that people who had committed sexual harassment were at this suite, and this is what it was called.
I think most people know that Bill Cosby was accused of a huge amount of rape and sexual assault allegations. But some of the context that's maybe useful is that those charges came in 2014, I think, and this photo and the is from the 2013 BlizzCon. However, it wasn't necessarily a complete secret to the world that some stuff might be going on with Bill Cosby. And that's where some of that grey area comes in terms of whether or not the suite name had anything to do with those allegations.
Yes. There's a full context around this, which is that, yes, that there are all these mitigating questions, which are, Gawker editor Tom Skoka posted, I think, I forget when, a big post that was basically like, did everyone forget that Bill Cosby has been accused on multiple occasions of sexual assault prior to when the case against him was reignited in the public eye.
Right.
And then also there were the other big part of that story was that there was a screenshot of a alleged text conversation between different Blizzard developers about meeting at the room and about bringing women back to the room and about Alex specifically wanting to have sex with certain women. And there's a way to read that, which is guys just making really shitty jokes to each other.
In a sort of frat boy culture way.
Right. It's one of those things that the screenshot spoke for itself in a way where this is the top level allegation that's being made against this studio, that all of these different behaviors, misconduct, mistreatment fall under this larger umbrella that people who have any conception of frat culture will understand to be, often white male dominated, aggressive, and sexually predatory. And here was this suite and this screenshot that are showing that exact behavior, regardless of the behavior that did or didn't take place around that.
Also, I guess it's proof that very senior developers within Blizzard were a part of that. And one of them, at least, I think Greg Street, or Ghostcrawler, as he used to be known, had somewhat distanced himself already from some of the allegations that had been made in the lawsuit. And then you see a picture of him in the Cosby suite with his hand on the Cosby photo with everyone else. And it was a useful thing to read and see in relation to like how high up the chain in Blizzard this stuff seemed to go. And also for those who haven't been to BlizzCon, like some of those developers, particularly if you're the game director of World of Warcraft or which I don't know if he was at the time, but Alex, that is.
Yeah, I think he was lead designer.
Right, but he's still going to be hosting panels. In fact, he was one of the people in the panel we referenced earlier. He was one of the people that mocked the woman we were talking about. And at BlizzCon, those people are mini celebrities as well. Like, that is not just a work trip. In relation to that story, how did you end up finding out about it in such detail and finding the photos and the screenshots themselves? Like, how did that come to you?
So that came through sources coming to us with information and saying that they were, aware of certain things that they heard about, contacting other people, and then, corroborating certain things that appear in the photos. It was, it was not Watergate type reporting. It was in the net of stuff where people are just coming and you put out calls for tips and for people to contact you through email. Mm-hmm. And every source you talk to, you ask them, can you please talk to another, anyone who you think might want to talk to us, please let them know that they can.
Yep.
And that they can speak to us off the record if they want. And so that's how all that stuff came through to us.
And were there any like different concerns that come up when you're posting images like that of people in the suite or some of the private messages? Like, are there any other things that you have to think about when you're doing that kind of reporting in terms of what should and shouldn't be included in the article?
100%. And that's conversations you have with your editor and your other editor and your editor-in-chief and with legal. And, at the end of the day, making a call about what is and isn't newsworthy and what should or shouldn't be included.
Right.
And what does or doesn't qualify as being, it's not like these were photos from, someone's cell phone taken, back in 2000 or something. The original origin of the photos was from Facebook. It's one of those things I think speaks to anytime stuff like this comes up. It's great that the video game industry is now, for lack of a better phrase, reckoning with it in a way that it hasn't before. But, Phil Spencer, the head of Xbox, recently gave an interview to Axios where he was unpromptedly apologizing for, I think it was a 2016 GDC party that Xbox was hosting right after it had done like a women in gaming event that day. That included women in, scantily clad, dancing on poles. I think they might have been in schoolgirl uniforms. And that was, I might be getting the date wrong, but that was like 2016. And there's this sort of collective amnesia that happens on the internet and just with the churn of the public record and contemporary news and stuff that like this stuff was all out in the open in a way that I don't think people often get. I mean, some of it was definitely not, but a lot of it was, and it was just a matter of what standards people were being held to back then. I mean, so that, and you know, the Cosby Group was being posted about on Facebook. It wasn't like some secret bone society where people are meeting in hoods in, you know, the basement at Yale or whatever.
It feels like stories like that one and a number of others at the time were playing a kind of an important role in countering some of the initial response from Activision Blizzard on a corporate level, which was that the lawsuit allegations were either distorted or in some cases just false. And then obviously more recently we've had like the Wall Street Journal reporting that Bobby Kotick, the CEO of Activision Blizzard, had known about a lot of these problems for years, which is again disputing a narrative that he and the rest of the board at Activision Blizzard had put forwards. How cynical does that make you feel about any kind of future responses you see from the company on that corporate level?
I mean, I'm already pretty, I think I'm as cynical as you could get at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very fraught relationship with most video game PR, at least at like, you know, I mean, people publish the labels representing like indie games are like sending me code and like, I'm like, this, you know, this game's great. Like, you know, let's do an interview or like talk to the devs or whatever. But like people at like big companies, because you know that they, I mean, I just have never gotten an honest response. I think there's this weird narrative in video games, especially, at least in the popular gamer discourse, where people generally think companies and the people running them are very smart and they're doing the things to make money. And, you know, a lot of the terrible people, what decisions people think are terrible when it comes to microtransactions or loot boxes or whatever, will always be like, well, you know, what do you expect? The companies, they're just trying to make as much money as possible. In my experience, these are companies run by people. And a lot of times the people who get to be in those positions tend to be not, they're not there because they necessarily have the most sound judgment or because they're the most risk averse or the most calculating. It's for any number of reasons. They just happen to be the person in the chair. That's a long way of saying that I think this, first of all, I think the Activision Blizzard story is far from done. I mm-hmm. think one of the things, even if you go back and read the original Activision Blizzard lawsuit, there's a fair amount in there that specifically references Activision. And a lot of the reporting that followed was mostly about Blizzard, in part because those were the voices that were most willing to speak out and were most public on Twitter. So to reporters, especially who had been following this, I don't think what was in the Wall Street Journal article, it was shocking, but not surprising. And for people who have been in the business for that long, you know, it's only sort of the tip of the iceberg. I mean, in my personal experience, not even reporting on Activision Blizzard, the worst things never make it into the reporting or the worst things you hear. And in some cases, that could be because they're unfounded or untrue. In a lot of cases, it's just because you aren't able to corroborate it further enough because a third or fourth person isn't willing to speak about it, or the person just doesn't want it out there. They want to keep it as private as possible. And so if they can lend credence to a systemic issue by saying, this is what happened to me, and this is the person I told, and that person tells you about how it happened to them, then it helps. But like, I think, you know, there's so many stories that don't get told that it's, for me personally, whenever I see a new report like this, it's always sort of a tip of the iceberg thing where it's like, you're thinking about all the things that didn't get included, that even the Wall Street Journal cut, you know, maybe they're planning follow-ups, but I'm sure that, you know, if they were Kotaku or an IGN, for instance, they would have had four or five stories based on what they got out of just that reporting. But because they're the Wall Street Journal, they have bigger fish to fry. They have other things to move on to.
We should also mention that, and it's something you alluded to already, that Activision Blizzard, we're often talking about here in terms of the corporate entity that it is. However, we saw something like 2,000 employees from Activision, Blizzard, and King who united in a very public way in support of the women who'd been mistreated and the allegations made in the lawsuit. That was in an open letter, but we'd also seen like major walkouts at Blizzard in particular. What kind of effect do you think that response from such a large portion of the employees has had so far?
I will cop to have been overly cynical about the initial wave of concessions that Bobby Kotick made in terms of mm-hmm. ending mandatory arbitration for sexual misconduct allegations, moves to have greater pay transparency and invest much more heavily in diverse hiring. And there was another
there was another big thing and I'm forgetting what it was.
Oh, is it the zero tolerance policy? Or was that just it?
Yeah. Yeah, so the zero tolerance policy, which, you know, is whether or not you can prove that they're sticking to it, but that's farther than Ubisoft has gone.
There does appear to be at least one example of someone who's not had a zero tolerance policy.
Right, zero tolerance except within, you know, all the exceptions to the zero tolerance for Bobby Kotick and others. I mean, yeah, a zero tolerance policy is only as good as the department enforcing it, which from all the reporting, the HR department, not just at Activision Blizzard, but at many gaming companies. I think especially gaming companies, in part because development is so tied into, it's not just like a company that's churning out widgets every year. And then they see like, oh, in the next decade, people are going to want less widgets. So we'll pivot to new products or do, it's like, there's a huge game that need, I mean, Call of Duty needs to hit its release dates. Overwatch, you know, is needs to be a huge seller. And so there's, I think, pressure at a lot of game companies for the HR departments. I've never had a good interactions with HR anywhere, but I think especially in games, based on my reporting, it seems like they're especially in the pocket of directors, producers, studio GMs who are, you know, have their primary goal is they need to ship a game on time, get a certain Metacritic, sell a certain number of copies, and then everything
and,
else is
secondary. And sacking the game director would be a bit of a speed bump to overcome.
Right. I'm sorry, I forget what your question was.
Oh, so my question was, what kind of effect do you think that so many employees coming together and taking action has had? For example, I guess when the something that stands out to me, when the Wall Street Journal article went live, there was a walkout planned and executed, I think, with it at Blizzard, that is, within 24 hours, calling for Bobby Kotick to step down. And to me, that would be unthinkable even just a few years ago to see that kind of organization in the US games industry so quickly. Is, I guess one question I have is like, do you think the US games industry is getting closer to unionizing with moments like this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question, and I have no idea. There's, I think, a lot more excitement or enthusiasm or a rediscovery around collective worker action, whether that's as part of a codified union or in some other way, that you see with, at least in the US, like small retail chains unionizing, not the whole retail chain even, but just particular stores. And, you know, relative to the amount of union participation there was around the post-World War 50s and 60s, it's like, it still barely registers. But I think it gets a lot of media attention because it's so counter to how things have been. And I think especially in game, I mean, I'm not a labor lawyer and I'm not well-versed enough. You know, one of the things that it sucks about there with games, they're like, there are just all these topics that you're being whipped around to try and cover. And it's all of a sudden, it's like, all right, I need to read up and become more knowledgeable about HR practices, not in games, but just like what's standard in the industry and what are HR professionals think, you know, how do they think actual departments should be run? And the same thing with labor, where it's like people at Google are trying to create a union that is not all of Google, but just like exists within a specific part of it. And, you know, you could totally see that happening with Activision Blizzard, where is every Call of Duty studio going to unionize? I strongly doubt it. And, you know, in part because there are people who just disagree with that they don't want to do that. It's, you know, some people will be afraid, other people just won't want to do it. And so maybe there's a way that that exists in smaller forms.
Well, it feels like at Blizzard in particular, there's been such visible solidarity in person as well. Like I know there were virtual walkouts at other studios, but at Blizzard, you know, people picketed outside of the front doors of the office. Like that feels different.
I think that's been one of the greatest ironies is how much, so much of the reporting was about what a cesspool Blizzard was for so long in terms of its workplace culture and what was allowed to happen and the boys club. And yet the Blizzard, you know, the redemption thing is that the Blizzard that people aspired to go work for many people was this good version. And that's what they're trying to continue to build now. And I think more forcefully, at least it appears, than at many of the other Activision Blizzard studios. And so I think it's a testament that that's how many people are at Blizzard who do not want that to be where they work. They want a better version of that. You know, they don't want to not make games. They don't want to not ship Overwatch 2. They just want to do it under different conditions.
I actually, when some of the layoffs happened two or three years ago now, and the EU office, which has been shut down now, we went over there to see some of the French union reps outside that office and talking to people and sharing information and making sure that people knew what rights they might have in terms of layoff packages and all the rest of it. But that was a handful of people standing outside the office. That it's so striking to see in reaction to this lawsuit, like literally hundreds of people coming together in California at the moment.
Yeah, and I don't know how much different that would be if COVID wasn't going on and everyone was in the office. So not mm-hmm. only would you have to leave the office to do it, but you would be seen by everyone who was at the office.
Right, yeah.
Not to say that, I mean, one of the things that Activision Blizzard committed to was not to retaliate against people. And I think now that there's so much attention on this, they'd be much more likely to be hit by the National Labor Review Board if they were appearing to do that. But I think part of that was a big thing for Ubisoft last year, and people speaking out there was just a certain liberation of not being at the studio every day under the eye of your manager, producer, director, and sort of feeling a bit more liberated to speak up about how you thought things should be at the company.
Do you think Bobby Kotick will... I've switched in Kotick and Kotick because you say Kotick.
Sorry, I always forget which one is correct.
I'm not even sure now, but like I'm just trying out both. Do you think Bobby Kotick will remain as CEO?
I mean, I don't have a crystal ball. He will die eventually, as we all do. I think Activision Blizzard, the company, will outlast him. I don't know. I think it will depend on what further reporting comes out and whether it just becomes too costly or too embarrassing. I do think there's a good case to be made that even if he were to resign, that as a board of director chairman, that he's, and you know, I think when people have, since the Washington the Wall Street Journal article came out, the focus has been very much on Bobby Kotick, and it's mm-hmm. easy because it's just easy to hate him. But there are tons of people who run Activision Blizzard that aren't him, that have been working with him for a long time, that have made their millions by being part of his machine. And so I think there's a part of, obviously it's a big victory if you can force the most powerful person at a company to leave over these things. But I think it's one of those things that only the collective labor action, like it's always the hardest part is like, what do you do after the fact? And like, can you maintain momentum mm-hmm. to keep things changing at the company, even when his face disappears from the coverage and the news? And I mean, that's, I basically am dodging your question, but no, I think he will, I think there will be pressure because of Call of Duty sales and just what the future of the company will be now that it's become this like monoculture company of Call of Duty and whatever Blizzard can ship. I don't know. I think at some point there will be enough people who just think it will be easier to make the money without him being attached to it. But I don't see him disconnecting himself completely from the company, just because I think when you're that type of business person and you've spent your life creating that, it would be like trying to cut off an arm or something. And I think that he would, yeah, unless something even worse, much worse than the allegations that have already come out specifically against him, that he would become so toxic that the company would not be able to function if there was even a whiff of him being in control. I don't see him leaving. I could see him resigning, but not leaving the company, if that makes mm-hmm. any sense.
You've written about the players who've chosen to boycott Activision Blizzard's games until some kind of significant change happens at the company. From the employees you've spoken to and from the reporting you've done so far, is that a useful way for members of the public to show solidarity with the employees and the victims? And what are those people saying about the idea of a more widespread boycott from members of the public who are pissed off and want to feel like they can help?
Yeah, I mean, it's the vote with your dollar is such a strong gamer. It's like a gamer slogan. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of thing that like people on podcasts and like the big personalities in gaming who go to the store and pre-order everything or are like constantly reading stuff, the people who are most tuned into that, like that's always the thing, is like, if you don't like loot boxes, stop buying the games and they'll change it. I think that it's a perfectly fine and understandable reaction for someone, you know, Call of Duty Vanguard is a great example. A lot of great people worked on that game, and I'm sure they feel both terrible about everyone who was wronged at the company or on his behalf, and also feel terrible that the game, that there are people who may not, who may stay away from the game specifically because of all of this and never get to see the work that they put into it. I mean, most of the game developers that I've spoken to will tell you, like, no, we don't want anyone to boycott the game. Like, what was the point of the last 4 years that I spent crunching on it if not for you to buy and see my contribution to it? You will hear people say a lot of bad things about Blizzard or about Activision Blizzard who worked there, but not about necessarily their teams or the people they work very closely with. You know, there's very strong... this happened a lot with Ubisoft where, you know, people would... They would tell you horror stories about a particular project, but their particular team, they loved, everyone was very talented, they got along great, and they felt like it was, you know, there's this sort of dual loyalty, that's not the right word, but like, you know, loyalty to the immediate team, not to the rest of the project or the management. And so I think there's even a mixed reaction among a lot of staff or an unease about championing a product right after something like this happens. And so you will see some people say, like, oh, everyone should boycott these products. And then developers will say, you're hurting the devs, or don't do that. There's an issue, I think, on both sides where I think people go overboard with trying to say that the moral thing to do is to, like, not buy these products and that you're bad if you do. Especially because it's one thing if you're like a three-person indie studio and you make a game and it's very clear, like, if you're directly supporting them or not. Versus a giant company where the money goes in every which direction and developers aren't even getting royalties. On the other hand, I think there's a bit too much in the rush to sort of support the people who work at these companies. I think there's sometimes too much deference paid to what they think should be done in terms of like an average player, like, you know, telling them that it's their duty to support the developer still because of this. I just think there's been an overreaction on both sides, and that, to me, the sort of like down the middle line is you should not, if you want to boycott the game, you should do it because you personally believe in doing it or don't want to play the game now because of these associations or support the company, versus doing it or not doing it because you think that's what a developer wants or will help them the most. You know, I think it's not a political action so much as like a self-expressive one. And so I think people are going to have more luck if they treat it like that rather than like a campaign.
And yeah, I guess we're putting out that hasn't been a request of the organization representing the employees directly as of yet anyway.
No.
Do you feel the same about coverage? So I guess in like, you know, we've seen examples of YouTubers and Twitch streamers saying that, you know, they'll no longer be playing or covering Activision Blizzard games for similar reasons. There have also been a couple of examples in the UK with sites like The Gamer creating a policy that they won't be covering Activision Blizzard games in any way until something happens, until that there is this like next step forwards. Is that an extension of the same thoughts you just had in relation to players?
Well, yeah, the issue there is always, what is the next step forward? Like, so Bobby Kotick comes out and says, we're doing zero tolerance, we're getting rid of mandatory arbitration, we're taking steps X, Y, and Z. You know, if you're a site who had stopped coverage, do you decide, well, now we can start doing coverage again because they have made those changes? Or do you say, okay, well, we will stop, we won't do coverage until Bobby resigns? And then even then, I think it would, you know, anyone would be reasonably sound in saying, well, but you know, have the issues really been fixed just because he's no longer there? And so I think that's when you get into the doing the sort of I don't know if it's called a media blackout, but yeah, if you start doing the boycott coverage from the media's perspective, I think you run into very quickly just that logistical question and philosophical question of like, so how do you decide when it's okay and not okay? Especially because there's a discrimination lawsuit filed against PlayStation, I guess it was last week. This PlayStation, whose head Jim Ryan had just recently put out a memo internally criticizing.
Yeah, the timing on that was
right, and so I think it's kind of like people love, especially in social media, love to have like heroes and villains, and you know every it's like the milkshake duck type thing. But like all these companies just any company is going to have bodies buried, and it's just a matter of who's get unearthed and who gets caught and who. So it's always like, I think it's somewhat naive to only boycott certain companies. You know, nobody was talking about boycotting Riot. Everyone has been covering all of Riot's, you know, the new Netflix show and League of Legends spinoffs. And that's not to say that they should or shouldn't, but I think it's just my personal feeling, and I'm a bit, I think probably much more the other way, is I don't see coverage as political in that way. And I think partly it's an issue of the enthusiast games press, that they appear so much to be championing whatever they cover. It's like, it's, I mean, there's this issue with reviews too, where it's like just the fact of reviewing a game is somehow you're giving a game extra visibility, even if you give it a bad score, even if you criticize it. I mean, because I think that was a big thing. It always felt weird, like when everything came out last year with Ubisoft, like how do you review, or not even review, like Assassin's Creed Valhalla, but how do you preview the game when all of this has just come out?
Yeah, because I guess there are two, well, there are multiple schools of thought, but the two opposing ones are that, you know, there should be this clear line of separation where you have your reporters and your news team covering the issues, and the review is there to just review the game, and that stuff gets left at the door, whereas other people would argue that how the game got made, the issues surrounding it are vital context for anyone wanting to purchase a product like that. And as someone who occasionally reviews games for Kotaku, where do you land on that? What should be, how much of that stuff should make its way into a review?
I'm very, I don't know if it's like agnostic or nihilistic, but like when it comes to reviews, I see them as like a piece of writing, and like, is, you know, the first and foremost, the piece of writing should be good. And I think of reviews much less about trying to unearth like truths that reside in the game or in the player or in their experience of the game, and more about, you know, do you have, what do you think is interesting about this game or worth letting people know about? And, you know, what is, because like people run into this issue where they think like if you review a game, you need to like talk about every facet of it, and you need to like go down the checklist of like, and the game's music was good and the graphics were this and the, and here's all the things you can do in the game. You know, the first Ubisoft game I ever tried to review, I remember just my editor at the time was like, stop telling me what's in the game and just tell me whether you thought it was good or not. And why, like, because you get into this trap where you're just listing like, and here's all the stuff, yeah, I did, and here's all the systems, and then you can do this. And so I think when it comes to reviews, like, I think if the context makes sense to you to bring up, and you have something to say about it, I think it's worth, I think there, you definitely shouldn't not do it because it's a review. At the same time, I don't think people are necessarily always wrong to not do it in a review. I think sometimes it can come across as paying lip service. I mean, I love Polygon, absolutely love Polygon, but there was a long running joke of the Polygon, sidebar, like early on in its creation, where there'd be this review and then the sort of like political question or a question of representation or, you know, something problematic in the game would be discussed in a sidebar. And it was this sort of like hedge between like, you know, it's not necessarily germane to like, will you enjoy this game or should you buy it? But we thought it was important to talk. And so I really, you know, I think it's for like each writer to an editor to decide, is it something that you're just going to mention like after you've talked about the game about like, and by the way, it was made using, you know, under crunch conditions, and, you know, I feel really bad about it. I'm always leery of that becoming sort of just like almost a disclosure about, yeah, just so you know, if you do get this game, like maybe you should feel bad about it.
So it'd almost be another thing to tick off on the list of graphics, audio, right, issues.
I'm blanking on the examples right now, but there are a lot of good reviews. Polygon runs, Vice's Waypoint, Kotaku, even though of course I'm going to say that, but that where I think there's a way where it makes sense for what a particular writer wants to say about a particular game. Mm-hmm. And not as part of a list. And I do think that there are obviously, it's weird because the games media is so big that there are obviously certain places where it is a conversation whether or not you would include that stuff. And I think that everyone should just write, like, I think it's fine to write, Ian Walker wrote a terrific review of Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 1 and 2 remaster or whatever. And it was just very short, and it just very like, you know, just talking about what he loved about the game. And it wasn't like, it has to be 2,000 words and I got to talk about all this stuff. And so I think in general, people should have much broader ideas about what a review can be, and it doesn't need to be anything. It could be one line. And sometimes that can be just a very poignant review. I mean, we've seen that, you know, I think Video Game Donkey on YouTube, like, some people probably wouldn't call certain videos reviews, but like, there are tons of different valid ways to talk about a game that don't require you to like fit into a certain format of what you think it's supposed to be.
I think both you and Patricia have mentioned Video Game Donkey on this podcast now, which is a fair reference point. Cool. Well, I guess I'll, for one final question, just because it's something that you've mentioned a few times as a comparison, you've also done a lot of reporting on Ubisoft as well as Activision Blizzard, and Ubisoft in 2020 was called out very publicly en masse for having a workplace culture that both encouraged and protected abusers, and it's something that you spent a lot of time learning about, just like you have with Activision Blizzard. I wonder what kind of common traits do those two companies share? Like, they're two huge video games companies with what seem like similar issues, but how similar are they?
Yes, there are definitely a lot of similarities with the workplace issues that people experience. Based on the 100-plus current and former Ubisoft developers I've spoken to this point, like, there were just certain teams, certain projects, certain studios where sexism and harassment were rife and just not a thing that anyone had an issue with, or, like, it wasn't so much like they were even failing to report it. It's just that it wasn't, again, it wasn't in that studio atmosphere. It wasn't a complaint that people prioritized versus, you know, so-and-so's not, you know, they're a roadblock in the pipeline and we need to get that fixed. And so we need to replace this team or replace the manager. You know, the biggest difference is that the one includes a lawsuit by the state of California and the other doesn't. I think that allowed Ubisoft to sort of, there just wasn't continual pressure. There wasn't, I guess, the risk of discovery that through the course of a lawsuit with regulators, stuff is just going to come out more so than you would ever get from any reporting, because by law, it's just they have to answer questions. I wish I could compel any gaming CEO to have to sit across from me and answer my questions. And Ubisoft is a very French company, and I didn't know what that meant when I started reporting on those issues last year, and I don't necessarily still know what it means, but there's definitely, from talking to different people, there's just a different, it's a company that was founded in France and is run out of France and is also global in a way that Activision is just extremely American. And they're just, I guess the political economy of both companies is just extremely different. Ubisoft has almost twice as many employees as Activision Blizzard, but does, I don't think, generates the same amount of, not definitely not nearly as much profit, but it's just, you know, it's just like, you look at the type of products, the pressures, like, so for me, a lot of, when you talk to people, a lot of these issues become manifestations of the pressures that teams are put under, and so what they care about and who gets to make decisions, and a lot of that is just driven by the portfolio of games. And so I think that just leads to a lot of differences in terms of managing, you know, when you've got 12 studios collaborating on an Assassin's Creed or a Far Cry, and some of them are speaking completely different languages, even though the language on all the studio floors is English. It just creates a lot of different issues. I will say that Ubisoft being in France, where there is a strong worker, a strong history of worker action and sectorial bargaining is built into the legal system there, I do find that while there aren't these larger protests that Blizzard has done, there are people, the most outspoken people about the corporate culture tend to be in France because they feel somewhat entitled to be that way. But yeah, it's, I don't know, I think for a lot of people, like, seeing Ubisoft, it's felt like this is sort of a 2.0, and it's going to be like, there's a world in which a year from now we're talking about, I guess, is it Infinity Ward's Call of Duty next? And that's, you know, this is, it's instead of being an entire story or a paragraph, it becomes one or two lines in a news story about, like, and by the way, last year, you know, this thing is still going in the court.
Because that's something you've written more recently about the Ubisoft allegations. And it was this huge, huge wave during the sort of the latest kind of Me Too movement in the video game space. And yet you've written more recently that despite all of the attention that received, employees feeling like not much had actually changed a year plus on. Is that potentially one future that we could end up seeing with Activision Blizzard, where all this attention and noise and potential for change is happening, and then the momentum isn't able to carry on?
This is my own theory. I think it's very expensive to do it right, or to even attempt to do it right. And the amount, especially to not just enforce a company culture, but to try and dramatically change it, would require a sort of like investment in human resources that, I mean, that's the one thing we found with Ubisoft, where people were just felt like the company had put all of these new systems in place, and now they just feel like their complaints are going into a black hole, and they're not getting just even follow-ups on, like, I made this complaint about this person, they did this, what are you going to do about it? And it's not even we looked into it and our determination is this, you can appeal that, you know, like there's, you know, and going through the procedure, it's, they just don't get a response back, or they say, oh, we're not going to investigate. And it's like, well, why not? And they don't hear back. And so I think where it really gets tough for these companies is the amount of resources you need to spend if you want to prioritize that thing and not prioritize shipping Call of Duty every year. And that is always going to be like, it's costly to do things right, to do right by people, and much more costly than a settlement, much more costly than $38 million or however much you're going to invest into more diverse hiring. And so I think that it's just, a union creates mechanisms internally for workers to enforce it themselves, which is one of the things that that Ubisoft workers in France were trying to do. They wanted to be a part of that process. So I think it's just the money it's not there to do it. Like, I just think it's much more expensive and harder than anyone thinks going in. If you just imagine all of a sudden you have hundreds of complaints from people and you've got to investigate them, and you've got to fire people who you don't want to fire because you think they magically are the person who can help create the next big Call of Duty IP. I mean, people internally at these companies have been talking about these issues for years. So it's not like this was all a secret. Nobody did anything about it because they didn't want to, and that's not necessarily going to change overnight.
Is this your beat now then? Is this what you will be keeping an eye on for at least until the end of this lawsuit proceedings with Activision Blizzard, but also any progress you end up seeing on Ubisoft side of things? Is this part of the world of video games that you want to report on and that you'll be on top of in the coming like months, maybe years?
It's hard to think about years in gameplay.
Okay, let's see how it scales with that.
I'm really excited that we have more resources now at the site than we did at the beginning of the year, and there's just a lot more people to chase down leads and do great work. And so I think it's definitely something I want to continue to do, but we'll also benefit from having collaboration with so many more people on the team. In addition to, I think the great work that people were already doing. I mean, I feel like everyone at Kotaku has written at least one Ubisoft story that wasn't just like an aggregation, but was in either a commentary piece or reporting. And I mean, I'm personally just drawn to it. I realized this throughout the process that I never knew I wanted to do video games writing. I especially didn't know I wanted to do video games reporting specifically. I always thought I was going to be some really interesting critic who would say all these wonderfully fascinating things about the biggest games. But I do just love talking to people and hearing their stories and just finding things out and discovering new things, especially if it's things the companies don't want you to know about. I mean, that's, you know, you have to be driven in a profession, not just out of like a sense of moral duty, but also because you like doing the work. And I think it's, so much of this stuff has been here for so long, and I hope it encourages more games journalists and up-and-coming games journalists to, you know, like one of the things that a lot of people have always felt like is that it's hard to break into games reporting specifically, not only because of the resource commitment, but because it's hard to get access unless you are at a big site or you have a big name. And I think one of the things that this should show everyone is that some of the biggest stories in gaming don't require that. It just requires reaching out to people over and over again until you find the you know, everyone's got a story. And when you can line up enough of those stories, you have it. As secretive as game developers can be, there are always ones who do want to share and find it very therapeutic to share and to be able to talk to someone else about that stuff. So I think I hope it will propel a sort of a growth in more gumshoe kind of hard news reporting in games specifically.
Ethan, thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me, Chris. I'm a big admirer of your work and of the podcast and of People Make Games.
And I would like to thank you for listening to this month's episode of The Games Press. If you want to support the show and the rest of our work at PMG, head over to patreon.com/peoplemakegames. We're almost entirely crowdfunded and very proud of that fact. That's patreon.com/peoplemakegames. See you next time.